Hello and welcome to the PCRS podcast series. In this series, we'll be bringing you experts on a number of respiratory-related topics. The podcast has been produced to update you and to give you food for thought about how you deliver your respiratory services.
So welcome to this podcast. It's about making people think about issues around respiratory. We hope that you'll engage with it. We hope that you'll contact us through the website if you've got questions or queries or anything to add. I'm Jane Scullion, nurse consultant at the University Hospitals of Leicester, and delighted to be with my colleague, Dr. Stephen Holmes from Shepton Mallet in Somerset.
Hi, Jane.
So today we're going to talk about shielding, because we mentioned this very briefly when we did our COVID podcast, and I think it's worth just spending, you know, a few minutes on, has the legacy of shielding been predictable, Steve?
Unfortunately, I think it's been entirely predictable. If you remember back to those days when they said, stay at home, stay safe, keep out of the way, there's a dangerous infection. Many of our population who were vulnerable, many of whom were had long-term conditions, were doing what they were told quite rightly. And that meant not going to the local shops, not getting the social contact they used to have, not taking their dog for a walk and getting a neighbour to do that for them, not meeting up with their family members or friends, and probably most importantly, not really getting out a great deal and keeping themselves fit.
Yeah, so I think the guidance was, wasn't it, that it either makes us hunks, chunks or drunks, or a combination of all of those. So some people drank to cope with it, some people exercised, so did the Joe Wicks workout every day, and some people sat on the settee and watched Netflix.
And sadly, I did ask at a central level about whether they had an alternative to Joe Wicks that perhaps some of our more senior people with disability could engage with. But I'm afraid it never came to fruition. But we know that when people aren't allowed out, that we're going to get predictable problems, don't we? And though probably the first two are easily memorable, and we'll see them, which is that seeing people who are frightened of catching the disease. They've got disease phobia. They don't want to go out. Even when they're told it's safe to go out, they are still very, very worried about the disease. And I think there's with good justification in many situations, but that can be affecting their mental health. And also a lot of people who have been much more isolated, not seeing grandchildren, not seeing their own children, not seeing their friends, not always having the technology. And we know that isolation and loneliness lead to depression in a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think we've seen that, you know, even with when we've been working remotely with our patients that have been our cohorts previously, that, you know, near the start of it, people would talk for quite a while on the phone, and some of our patients have totally disengaged. So as you say, the ones that have no family surrounding them, have been lived on government parcels delivered outside their flat door, initially would want to talk to anybody. And then when we tried to contact them and stay in touch, they would just say, I'm fine. And that was it. And you just feel for all these people, because people are still living like this. It's not everybody who has gone into a shop. Some people have never gone into a shop for now 18 months or more.
And the longer it goes on, probably the harder it will be for them to make that first step, especially when often you go into shops and there's a variety of security measures in terms of infection control on display, both by the population and by the different shops.
Yeah, so apart from the, you know, sort of mental health side of deconditioning, the other things we need to think about are probably, you know, increased risk of infection from not moving around, from not mobilizing secretions, which leads to worse respiratory outcomes. We've also seen increases in falls. What other things were we seeing?
I guess the thing that I'm seeing a lot clinically, and I when I speak to colleagues, they're saying the same. And I think probably we need to have a really strong change in the way in which we assess people is people coming in saying, I'm more breathless than I used to be, or I can't walk as far as I used to. And I think our first thought should be, how much exercise have they been doing over the last 2 or 3 years, not let's ramp up some medication and see if it makes a difference. A lot of these people will be much less fit than they used to be.
And you know, in terms of diet as well, because we've seen, you know, you're talking to people and they're more breathless and checking their BMI or asking them, you know, have you put on weight? And we've seen an awful lot of people who have put on a couple of stone or more contributing to their breathlessness.
Yeah, and that's not easy if you're just doing telephone consultations. So really think carefully about the person you're speaking to. It's easy to imagine because of the voice what the person is like. One of the tips I've got would be whenever you're speaking to somebody on the phone, just have a quick look at the body mass index and their past medical history and other things about them, because you're not going to pick that up speaking to them.
So how are we going to deal with this? How are we going to help people? And I guess it probably goes back to what we talked about in the COVID recovery. It is about mental support, is about physical support, but also about that listening skills for people. You know, where are they at? How do you help people come out of their shells and join the world?
Yeah, and I think probably my pragmatic approach for people coming in is, if it's someone with asthma who's saying, my breathing's worse than it used to be, I can't do what I used to. If I'm not hearing a wheeze, if their peak flow is normal, I'm thinking, okay, how can I get them to exercise more? I might want to think about checking inhaler techniques and the normal things we would do. But what I'm going to be doing is saying, a lot of this sounds as though we just need to make sure you're getting fitter. There are health connectors in many areas who have access to sports and leisure centres and structured therapy to get you fitter. There are a lot of pulmonary rehab and other programmes around to improve overall fitness. And I think we really need to be maxing this out over the next year. Perhaps you might think I'm biased about wanting people to be fitter, but I'm going to stick with that at the moment.
No, I'll back you on that one, Steve. I think it's a good idea. And I think, again, it's that giving people permission. And I think back to a gentleman I saw in very early days who'd been hospitalised with COVID but made a reasonable recovery. But when you asked him about his lifestyle, he lived in an extended family but wasn't going anywhere near his grandchildren or the family, had gone back to live in one room because he didn't understand he was no longer infective. And actually the permission I gave him was, go home and put one of the grandchildren on your knee and have a hug.
Yeah. And that goes a long way. We think about the importance of deconditioning and exercising. And it's important to remember that the more you exercise, the better your mental health becomes. The same with hugging children and releasing chemicals that we can measure that actually help us, if you like, natural opiates that make us happier and make us more positive about life in general. So we have big opportunities to change our population around now if we get the chance.
I always wondered why your mental health was good, and it's obviously all this running you're doing, Steve.
Yes, I'm sure it helps. But I guess the other thing, just as an aside on that, is very interesting literature around happiness. And a lot of us are happy because of how much is in our natural body to do that. So about 50% of our happiness is genetic. This is from a literature review done about 10 years ago. About 40% is how we respond to a social situation. And about 10% is the situation that we're actually in.
So loads of food for thought.
Lots of food for thought. So any thoughts about deconditioning, we would love to hear. We know that it's important. I think it's a challenge for clinicians to decide when it's a worsening of that underlying lung condition and when it's purely deconditioning. But if we get everybody as fit as we can, even with significant heart disease, we'll get better outcomes.
Great to talk.
Lovely to see you, Jane. Take care.
Thank you for listening. Please remember to subscribe for future podcasts. Goodbye.